Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackanddrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, you're going to be hearing the interview that I recorded just over a week ago with a talented young man from Kenosha named Nicholas Daly, who is now studying music theater at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Perhaps you've had the pleasure of seeing Nick Daly on stage in any number of memorable music theater productions by Kenosha Unified. Among the greatest of his successes was his performance in the title role of The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Nick Daly has felt very much the pinch of restrictions over the last several months during this time of COVID-19, which of course has struck such a blow into the performing arts in general. But one of the great joys which Nick Daly has experienced, even in the midst of all of this frustration, was an incredible triumph which he scored in Playbill Magazine's Search for a Star contest. Over 2,700 singers from across the country competed virtually in this competition, in which an all-star lineup of professional judges from Broadway winnowed down that large field into a top 10. At that point, it was turned over to the general public for their voting, and in the end, Nick Daly was judged the grand prize winner. It's a great feel-good story for the city of Kenosha at a time, of course, which is in so many other ways very, very difficult and challenging. I appreciate Nick Daly making time in his schedule to join me on the morning show to talk about his triumph in the Search for a Star contest. I asked him first to explain how he even found out about the contest in the first place.
Well, my journey this quarantine began with me feeling a bit lost because there was no work for a performer because of the COVID shutdown. And so I was stuck in my room just thinking, like, what can I do? I have to be creative. I cannot just sit still and work a part-time job somewhere. So I started recording content and posting it on TikTok. And from there, yeah, things just started growing. I gained a little bit of a following. And when the Playbill contest was announced, I had lots of TikTok followers, who I'm so grateful for, who suggested that I participate in the contest, and they were tagging me in videos and they were messaging me. And it was overwhelming. So I decided to participate.
And just to be clear, I suspect that a lot of these people who saw what you were doing on TikTok are people that you didn't know. I mean, this isn't just, you know, some of your old buddies from high school or former teachers or whatever, but this is, in a sense, complete strangers. Have been exposed to you and your voice and your artistry only very recently. Is that right?
Yes. Since the beginning of quarantine, which was about April, May. Since I had been home, I have been growing. A lot of my following on Instagram is actually primarily in Kenosha. A large percentage is in Kenosha. But on TikTok, it's across the country, overseas. So, yeah, a lot of people that I do not know, but I'm support me, and I'm so grateful for that. So. Mm-hmm.
So tell us what you had to do to enter the Search for a Star contest sponsored by Playbill Magazine. What were they asking for? And is this something that anybody could enter?
Yes, it is open to everyone except for Broadway performers. they asked for I believe, 1 minute cut of a song, just something that shows off your range, and they asked that they actually used the Accepted app, which is also, I was familiar with it because we used it for the college pre-screens,
so for that process, for application.
Yes, yeah. The college pre-screen process. There we go. I submitted my video on there, and I also posted it on Instagram using the hashtag PlaybillStar and tagging Playbill in the post.
And what was the song that you chose, and what did you think about in choosing it?
I sang I'm Not Afraid of Anything from Songs for a New World by Jason Robert Brown. And I had actually just recorded a TikTok of me singing that exact cut. and funnily enough, the accompaniment in my submission video is actually a TikTok. There is a content creator on TikTok and Instagram, and his handle is @Dewey's Piano Party. And he uploads musical theater accompaniment tracks for TikTokers like me to duet. And he did I'm Not Afraid of Anything in a tenor key. And it was like, it felt so good on my voice. And I'm Not Afraid of Anything is just such a wonderful song for an actor. So it was fresh in my body, and I decided that at that moment, it was the best song for me to perform.
Yeah, and connect to. This is a song that Jason Robert Brown intended for a very different kind of singer. It's not originally a tenor song at all. And it's a real handful for both the pianist and the singer. But so you were able to find this accompaniment that shifted it into your range, which is tenor, and the rest is history. So you submitted this, and then roughly how long did you have to wait before you got the good news that you had been chosen as one of the top 10 of the 2,700 singers who had made submissions? Was that a long and hard wait?
Ooh, I think I was actually one of the week two highlights. So every week Playbill like chose a couple of submissions to highlight and on their website. So at some point during week two, in the beginning, I believe, I uploaded my submission. And I think I waited about 3 weeks until the top 10 were announced. And then another week of voting. And then I found out that I was the grand prize winner.
Incredible. I think one of the neatest things about this contest is that in terms of those 2,700 submissions, that, as I said earlier, it was a panel of expert judges who made the determination about who would be the top 10 before it starts turning it over to the general public. give our listeners some sense of just what I mean by an expert panel of judges and their connection to this world, this business.
I mean, these are Broadway people, Broadway directors, choreographers, casting directors. I just did the Playbill Live interview, and that was with Benton Whitley, who is the casting director for Hadestown, and he was one of the judges, and yeah, all of his colleagues as well.
Right. So when you are named the top 10 out of this huge field of singers, when you're named in the top 10 by experts like that, it really means something. Extraordinary compliment in and of itself. And then things get turned over to the general public. And as we've already said, you were the grand prize winner. One of the things that's really cool about this is that the list of prizes that mm-hmm. you receive are really wonderful and appropriate for a young singer. I'm not sure you won anything in the way of money, and you didn't win a car or a new refrigerator, but you have been given a number of very, very special prizes that for anybody who's interested in musical theater, just kind of make your heart stop. They are so exciting. So give our listeners a sense of some of what you get to experience because of winning this contest.
Yes. Well, yesterday I did the, I was on Playbill Live, and I was able to perform, which was such an awesome experience and such great exposure. And they also just created such a welcoming environment. But that was a really awesome opportunity. And I will have a consultation with Stuart Whitley casting, I believe next Monday. And yeah, there are songs that I have to prepare for that. A lot of the prizes, I remember when I found out I had won, I was like, oh my gosh, this is so incredible. I get all these opportunities, like a work session with Susan Stroman, Broadway director, choreographer, Susan Stroman. Tony Award winning director, choreographer, Susan Stroman. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so insane. I'm so grateful. But the work, now the real work begins, because mm-hmm. now, you know, I'm preparing my three contrasting songs for my consultation and figuring out what song and monologue that I want to do for, you know, the work session with Susan Stroman. So yeah, it's really awesome, and I'm so grateful. And it is work. It's still definitely work, that I'm very fortunate to do.
Well, right. Exactly. And as you touched on, this comes at a point in time when, performance opportunities are all but non-existent, especially in live audiences, in auditoriums. I mean, that's just hardly happening anywhere at all right now. And so this comes at a marvelous point in time for you. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with the Kenosha native Nick Daly, a former voice student of mine, and the grand prize winner of the Search for a Star contest sponsored by Playbill Magazine. Nick, one of the things that Benton Whitley said in this Playbill Live program that you were talking about earlier, and we should mention, he is a casting director on Broadway, has worked on the casting for some of the most important shows in recent years. One of the things that he said in that, in praise of you, is there are lots of skilled singers in New York City, but not many joyous storytellers. So he was really taken not only by your capacity to tell a story when you sing a song, but also the joy with which you do it. And I wonder, to what do you attribute that? And I mean, where do those two particular skills, if we want to call it that, come from, or gifts?
Wow, that was just so wonderful to hear. But I definitely think that as an artist, empathy is always at the forefront for me. Like, that's the most important thing. That's why I do what I do is to strengthen my own empathy muscle and to also, you know, allow the audience to participate in that exercise. So I think having that foundation, which I learned from, you know, being a student in KUSD theater, being under Holly Stanfield and learning from her. I definitely think that bringing my joy into the room is a skill that I learned from being trained in that environment. And also, I mean, I have the most loving family in the world. I have such a supportive system. My two little sisters are everything to me. And I don't know, especially this quarantine, just like being able to be with them. I watched my younger sister, Madison, full time this summer. And that was a wonderful grounding experience. And I learned how to be present and just enjoy people's company and not let a moment go for granted, and saying everything you need to say. But yeah, I definitely think that I carry all of that with me wherever I go. So,
you have mentioned that this is a tough time for anybody who's in the performing arts, and particularly anybody who loves theater, whether they're just an audience goer or whether they're a performer or backstage or whatever. I mean, with so much of the industry in a sense paralyzed for the moment, not too much longer, but. What about your schooling at the University of Michigan? Has it been like to try to carry on with your training under the shadow of COVID, the end of the spring semester, first of all, and of course, the start of this fall semester? What did it feel like?
It was definitely a shock to not finish out freshman year the way that we had planned to. It was very abrupt. I felt like there wasn't that closure that you get at the end of a school year. I mean, we did kind of have that moment in our online classes, but you know, once the meeting ends, then it's over. Like there's no dialogue after. That was a little odd. And I have to say, like starting on Zoom classes, which is what we've been doing, most of our classes are 100% online. There are some classes that are a hybrid, but all classes are offered on Zoom. At least for our degree. But it has been difficult, especially since I'm dealing with Wi-Fi issues at our apartment at the moment. So online classes are very difficult. But some of the lecture classes do translate pretty well. I know I'm in a script analysis class that is really awesome. We have sophomore performance, which that was very interesting because a lot of us musical theater majors were living with each other. I have a roommate that's a musical theater major. So when we're Zooming in these classes, there's like two or three people per screen. So in my sophomore performance class, our teacher had us perform our songs with scene partners like that are in our homes. Just an innovative way of you know, dealing with the current situation. But it's difficult, but I am definitely still grateful to be able to practice my craft and still be able to learn.
And of course, it's something that the whole world is dealing with right now. I mean, so young musical theater students like yourself here and across the country and around the world. I mean, you know, young people in Norway and Morocco and Thailand and wherever else, all dealing with this unhappy reality and trying to make the best of it and trying to be creative with it. And it sounds like that's one of the things that you have done. When you think about the kind of singer you are right now on the stage, I mean, I'm really talking about the music theater aspect, which is, of course, what means the most to you. In what way do you think you are a different performer than you were a few years ago, what would you point to as the most important ways in which you have grown over the last several years?
I think when I had first decided that, well, not decided, when I had first accepted that musical theater was my calling, I think I had the idea in my head that Broadway was what I wanted to do, and only what I wanted to do, that I wanted to be a performer, that I was a performer, and I thought that was my calling. But as I've continued to train and continue to experience just living and life, I've found a connection to something that is so much deeper than just being a performer, but being a storyteller in the most human sense. Like in the beginning of time, when there were people sitting around campfires and telling stories, like I am now a member of that tradition. So yeah, I definitely think the way I view myself has changed. And I think that has also impacted the way that I perform.
One of the things that we should take at least a little bit of time to talk about is the fact that this spectacular, wonderful thing has occurred for you in a time that is incredibly painful. I wonder, I'm very anxious to know your thoughts about what it was like to have your hometown in the middle of this huge, painful story, and for you to not be there. I mean, to be just kind of reading about it, and what it was like to experience this joyous victory in the wake of this really painful time in Kenosha. What has this been like for you?
Yeah, well, I was home when the incident happened.
Still in Kenosha.
Yes, I was still in Kenosha. I actually live a 3-minute walk from downtown. So it was very shocking. The original shock was obviously seeing the video and realizing that that was happening blocks away. And yeah, the Playbill top 10 announcement happened before the incident. And so people were, at least all of the other performers that made it to the top 10 were posting and just encouraging people to vote, which I did originally. And then the Jacob Blake shooting happened, and I just didn't feel like I felt like there was something more important for me to do, that I needed to be there for my community. And my mom's probably going to be upset at me for saying this, but I did not vote for myself. I did not publish a lot of, encouragement to vote for me, because I was very focused on, protesting. I protested the second night. It was a wonderful experience. There were speakers and so much passion and so many different people of all shapes, sizes, hues, orientations, creeds. I felt like I was a part of something so much larger than myself, a part of a movement that is not only, a national movement, but, a global movement for egalitarianism, for equity and inclusion and diversity. Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why it was such a shock to me that I won, because I felt like I wasn't necessarily putting in the amount of work that I should have been, or that I would have been in a different circumstance.
In a sense, that sweetens the victory, because it's not like you were there priming the pump and reminding people who already knew you and supported you to vote. You were busy working on something far more important, and those who supported you and liked what you did, they voted without your prompting, and that makes the victory even more special.
Absolutely.
Now, when you think about this important cause of working for a more just world for everyone, and particularly for people of your own community. How do you see your work as a musical theater performer folding into that? I mean, does that seem like something kind of frivolous by comparison, or does this feel like something that can be, in a sense, a really important mission for you?
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said earlier, I consider myself a storyteller, and storytelling has always been important for pushing for social change. Storytelling for me, I'm not just one thing. I'm not just a musical theater performer. Because I see myself as a storyteller, I'm also a playwriting minor. I've been submitting for TV shows and things, as everyone else has, since, you know, they're the only ones that are getting back to work. But I as an artist, as a storyteller, I think that the media, meaning like the TV shows that we see and the movies that we watch and the shows that we go to see, all influence the way that we see ourselves and the way that we see others. And I think because racism is a systemic issue, it's so ingrained in every level of our society, the only solutions have to be systemic. And my corner of the universe is performance. And so changing that industry and being representation and advocating for, you know, BIPOC performers and writers, which is so important, because the writers are there. Like there are writers of color that are working, but they're just not as visible. And I think that's what needs to change.
I know that you also, through the course of this competition, heard from at least a couple of different cast members for Hamilton. That's what I've been told. And of course, for those who aren't aware of it, one of the most remarkable things about Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton is, in a sense, the colorblindness of the casting. And I suspect that is something really exciting for you to think about, is the day when that won't even be remarkable anymore. That will be the norm by which casting occurs at a place like Broadway.
Yeah. I think for Hamilton, especially, not necessarily color blind casting, but very color aware and color conscious.
That's a better way. Yeah.
Yeah, celebrating, you know, brown skin on stage.
Right. In other words, it was not a happy accident. To some extent,
yes,
by design.
Yes, very intentional and effective. Hopefully one day we will have more of that, so that it does not become remarkable. And there are issues with everything. Because of the society that we live in, I could not look at a single piece of work and not find one social flaw in it somewhere. So I think, as a society, as we continue to know better, we have to continue to do better. So Hamilton is one step on the path, and hopefully there will be even more representation for, you know, performers of all different shapes, sizes, colors, and creeds. So.
And how exciting to think about you being in the mix of all of that. Nicholas Daly, grand prize winner of the Search for a Star contest, sponsored by Playbill Magazine. And Nick, it's been great to reconnect with you. Congratulations on this wonderful victory. And I hope we'll be able to reconnect down the road a little ways once you've had some of these wonderful encounters. It would be wonderful to be able to talk with you about what it was like to sit down with Tony Award-winning Susan Stroman and to have some of these other experiences that come with this well-deserved victory. Congrats again, and thanks for being part of the morning show today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And to finish out, Here is a brief sample of Nicholas Daly's wonderful singing. This is a moment from the musical Thoroughly Modern Millie.
Don't forget me, Romeo and Juliet. Me fly, dove, sing, sparrow. Give me fat boy's famous arrow. Give me that thing called love.
The beautiful voice and artistry of Kenosha's own Nick Daly, the grand prize winner in Playbill Magazine's Search for a Star contest. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we turn to an interesting interview from the Morning Show archives, an interview which was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2007. For more and more people living in the United States, English is not their first language. And more people who find themselves in this country are confronted with the challenge of being fully functioning citizens and enjoying all of the benefits of living here without necessarily being able to speak or read English. And it's an interesting story, and depending on where you live, it might be, for you at least, a largely untold story. A book which is written to help us understand this experience, this challenge, this dilemma, is called How I Learned English. It comes from National Geographic. The subtitle, 55 Accomplished Latinos Recall Lessons in Language and Life. This comes just in time for National Hispanic Heritage Month. And just as discussions and debates continue to expand about immigrants among us, undocumented aliens, and what it means to be a full citizen, and the important role which language can play in that. And this is a release which can really speak clearly and potently to this important topic. The editor of the book is Tom Miller, who has been bringing to the public a whole host of fascinating books, most on travel, including The Panama Hat Trail, On the Border, Trading with the Enemy, Jack Ruby's Kitchen Sink, and much, much more. He makes his home in Tucson, Arizona, and we speak with him for the next few minutes about How I Learned English.
Good morning,
Miller. Good to be talking with you. This is a topic which is of great interest to me, and I'm sure to many of our listeners, so I am really happy that we can do this. Did anything in particular inspire you to put this book together as you did?
You know, it was gradual, and at one point it all crystallized. It was gradual because when I moved to the Southwest from the East Coast some 35 years or so ago, I was working as a journalist, and a lot of the stories that I would be covering involved people whose second language was English, and this intrigued me. I'd not really run into this back east. Now, we're talking the late 60s here. And more, I was intrigued with how their use of English and it being a second language, how it changed their fundamental life. It wasn't just I before E except after C. It was a lot more detailed than that. As their English became better, it shifted in their there was a shift in their personality. As their English became better, there was a shift in their social and professional lives. So I got to see it first as subjects of what I was writing, then as colleagues, as I would go into Latin America from here in Arizona. And then a lot of these people became my friends, and so I was able to witness the process going on. And finally, I married into a Spanish-speaking family, and so the whole process was complete at that point, and the whole learning English was something I witnessed intimately, both with my wife and my two stepsons. And at one point, it all crystallized into the notion of how do people learn English?
Mm. As you observed, especially the latter, your wife and you said two stepsons, I think. Yes. Was there anything in particular about their process of learning English that you found especially striking, where you thought, this is interesting enough to write a book about?
Well, I guess anecdotally, yes, because, you know, you learn, sometimes you learn more from your mistakes than you do from just a regular lesson. My wife, when she went into her first ESL class, her first day, she came home and I said, what did you learn? And she said, oh, really? That's interesting. What was the teacher like? Oh, really? That's interesting. She had learned four words that day, the superficial nicety. Oh, really? That's interesting. It's become a running joke since then. You know, and not long thereafter, I was in one room in the house and she was in another trying to put a CD on. And she came in, she said, I think there's something wrong with the CD player. I said, what do you mean? She said, come take a look. She put on a CD, and it didn't have the music she expected. She showed me the cover. She was expecting Billie Holiday. It was a CD of country music songs for the Christmas season called Hillbilly Holiday.
Oh, dear.
She saw Billie Holiday on the cover and rightly assumed that this would be the blues coming out. Instead, she got Commander Cody and his last Planet Airman.
Dear. Of course, not knowing the most pervasive language can really have consequences that are a little more serious than that, although I'm sure that was no fun. But I'm sure as you have pondered this topic and talked to some of these guests, you've come to a deeper appreciation than most, probably, about the difference it can make to know the most important language in a given nation. So, for instance, English here in the United States. I mean, what do people lose when they are living here without knowing English?
Well, what they gain immediately is they gain a far wider possibility in their professional lives and a far wider possibility in their social and personal lives.
When they know English.
As they accumulate English in their brain. And I say that because the more, you know, your brain just has a certain capacity. There's just a certain limit. And so the more people integrate English into their lives, the less they're using Spanish. And at some point, they realize, my God, I've kind of forgotten the word for this or the verb for that. My Spanish isn't as good as it used to be. It's because my English has gotten so good. And so they go back and try to brush up on their Spanish, and they go back and forth. And this is one of the impetuses for bilingualism right there.
I have had relatively limited experience in this in my own life, but I can think of a couple of cases where I have found myself kind of struck by this situation. For instance, the college where I teach, for a long time, the woman who was the custodian we saw the most in my little corner of the building was Hispanic and spoke very, very little English. I mean, almost none at all. And so on a very practical level, it was kind of tricky because if she would swing by my office, it would be all but impossible for me to explain to her that I would like you to throw this away, but this is something I need to keep, even though it looks like garbage or whatever. I had a really messy office at the time, and so I needed to be able to communicate with the custodian, but of course that was really difficult. Only after the fact did I learn that this woman had been a professional of one kind or another. I don't remember what she was back in Mexico, I believe, a teacher, I think, or something like that. And because she found herself here in the United States at that point in time with barely any English facility whatsoever, this was where she found herself. I felt badly that at the time I was looking at this question only through the eyes of someone who was sort of inconvenienced by it, and then only later realizing that for her this represented a far deeper loss than that.
Well, you know, a situation like that requires some personal patience on your part and some you know, extra courses on her part. I think if she was somebody who wanted to go beyond being a cleaning lady, some ESL classes might have come in handy. Now, a lot of times they are charged for these. Sometimes ESL classes come at no charge whatsoever. They're free. They're community-wide. There's, I must say, Greg, there's a line halfway to Guadalajara from people who want to enroll in ESL courses. And this woman who was cleaning your office is just one example of one of these people.
Hmm. So your book tells us about 55 different Latinos who managed one way or another to learn English. And if I remember correctly, we're talking about 55 notable Latinos.
Yes, that's right. Some of them are well known. If you watch Spanish language television, we have Don Francisco, we have Cristina, we have Walter Mercado. Some of them are well known if you follow Major League Baseball, going back a generation or so, Juan Marichal, Orlando Cepeda. Some of them are well known if you follow mainstream literature, Ariel Dorfman, Francisco Goldman, Ruben Martinez. These are names that ring a bell with different people in different fields.
I think one of the last names you just mentioned is someone who learned English, or at least began to pick it up, while hospitalized. Tell us that story.
You're speaking of Ariel Dorfman.
Right.
Yes. In fact, it's curious because he has almost the exact same story as Oscar Iguelos, another person in American mainstream literature. In both their cases, they were raised in Spanish-speaking countries, and at a very young age, they suffered some sort of malady that hospitalized them. When they went in, they were speaking only English, and we're talking, early 50s, mid-50s or so. And when they came out of the hospital, they were speaking English. It's because the people who were working in the hospital were English speakers, and in those days, very few other languages. It's because it was either learn this new language or you simply didn't improve. And their families were all amazed at this extraordinary change in the linguistic abilities of young Ariel and young Oscar.
Hmm. It sounds like a number of the stories in your book surround such experiences as this, in which English is not learned in a classroom, but learned in some really surprising ways.
Tell us
a couple of other examples of that.
Well, as I mentioned, Don Francisco, who has that wonderfully tacky Saturday afternoon show called Sábado Gigante on Univision Television. It's a variety show. It's sometimes he has a documentary, short documentary film in other visiting other countries. It comes out of Miami. He has guests on there. He has Coochie Coochie Girls. They have little TV game show type of abbreviated versions. It's a wonderful three-hour variety show. When he was in his late teens, he grew up in Santiago, Chile. He came to New York, and in order to learn English, he would go to the entrances of the subways and approach people saying that he was lost and could they help him. Well, again, we're talking late 50s, early 60s, I think. And people would notice his accent and say, oh, where are you from? And, of course, this would draw out a conversation. The conversation would go on at length, as would the instructions of how to get where he was going, and he would pick up new vocabulary this way. He would then write down the new words, and at the end of the day, when he got back to this little apartment he was renting, he would look them all up in the dictionary, and he would build up his own personal dictionary. This was his way of learning English. Each of these people has their own special trick, their own trampa, their own way of assimilating, accumulating, and otherwise making English the dominant language in their lives.
Hmm. I think for a lot of us, we can't imagine learning English from Frank Sinatra records, and yet, you know, it really says something exciting about human beings and our capacity to learn, that we find ourselves able to learn even maybe under the most unlikely of circumstances or in ways that are really pretty amazing.
You know, you mentioned Frank Sinatra. That's a good example. Young Jose Serrano in Puerto Rico, his father comes home from World War II, having served in the U.S. Army, and he's got a stack of 78s, and they're Frank Sinatra. So young Jose puts them on, and he picks up English words. Sinatra had terrific pronunciation. He picks up pronunciation. He picks up vocabulary, diction. There's just everything about Sinatra, pacing, cadence. And this became the foundation of Jose Serrano's English. The family then moves to New York from Puerto Rico. Serrano is a big baseball fan. He listens to the Yankees. He hears broadcaster Mel Allen, and he learns more about cadence, how to fill dead time. He listens to the Dodger games with Vin Scully. Eventually, Serrano grows up. He becomes very active in community affairs and politics. He's now a congressman from the Bronx.
Amazing.
It started with Frank Sinatra. On the other hand, there's somebody in the book. She's an editor at a major publishing house in New York. She's was raised in Ecuador. She listened to Olivia Newton-John.
Hmm.
Now, Frank Sinatra and Olivia Newton-John don't have a whole lot in common, but I dare say that for learning English, both of them serve their purpose.
I'm sure there are a lot of stories about how frustrating it is to learn English and that English breaks its own rules so much. I mean, those of us who speak it as a first language probably forget just what an unpredictable language it is, and I'm sure very frustrating for a lot of these people to truly master.
Especially if they're coming from Spanish, whose rules are fairly straight and whose pronunciation, you know, every letter in Spanish is pronounced, and all of a sudden you're confronted with a language that has all these silent letters in it or curious ways of pronouncing the same sequence of letters that changes from word to word. You have no idea unless you're confronted with this. Fortunately, a lot of these people, you know, we talk about English being their second language. For a number of them, it was their third or fourth or even fifth language. One of the book's contributors was raised in a Mayan village in the Yucatan in Mexico. Maya was his first language. He went to school in the small village, and the teachers said, don't speak Maya. That's for low-down people. You want to speak Spanish. If you want to get ahead in life, you need to speak Spanish, not Maya. Maya is for dirty people.
Hmm.
So the kid learns Spanish. Then he moves to the United States, and he realizes, no, you don't want to speak Spanish here. You want to speak English. So he took ESL classes. He eventually rose in his chosen field, which was electronics. He became a senior engineer at Microsoft.
Wow.
It's quite extraordinary from a small Mayan village to really the pinnacle of American computer technology.
Hmm. A last question. So what do you hope the impact of your book will be? I mean, what is its most important purpose?
The image of the immigrant is somebody dying in the Sonoran Desert, of a campesino with a wide-brimmed hat, of somebody illegal hiding in the kitchen somewhere, of a construction worker in Houston. I think these people show very clearly that so many immigrants have achieved so much and English has become part of it, that it's not in bilingualism, two languages or more, is nothing to be afraid of. On the other, quite to the contrary, it's something to be encouraged.
Hmm. We should mention that your book has also been released in Spanish, so that, for instance, people who need to do this or whose lives would be bettered by doing this have the opportunity to read your book and maybe gain some inspiration.
Yes, it's exactly the same under the title Como Aprendí Inglés.
And for us who speak English only or read English only, How I Learned English, 55 Accomplished Latinos Recall Lessons in Language and Life. And editor Tom Miller, I thank you so much for joining us today on The Morning Show.
It's been a pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Bruce Boyce, a whistleblower in the pharmaceutical company. His memoir about taking that courageous step is called Cold Comfort. On Wednesday, a look back at one of the most glamorous teams in NFL history, the 1950s Los Angeles Rams, with Jim Hawk, whose father was a member of that illustrious team. On Thursday, Nan Calvert. On Friday, we hear from the Racine Symphony. Support for the Des Moines Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. We're approaching 9 o'clock.